If you were with us last Sunday, we began our final story of the Old Testament journey. This is it. We finally got to the end of this long road. But we started a story from the book of Esther last week. I want to remind you of what takes place. If you missed last week, you're going to miss the first part of the story. You can go to our website. If you're watching this online, especially later, like a later time, you can go back and watch the other message first. Or listen to it, but otherwise, I'll give you a quick review for a few minutes here of what we talked about last week, in case you either missed it or you need a refresher. Here's a few major characters from last week's story. First, we had King Xerxes. Xerxes was the king of the Persian Empire. The Persian Empire was in its prime, although by the time Xerxes is done being king, it's kind of sliding off the rails a little bit. It's got a couple generations to go. He's a powerful man, but not a good man. But he has a bunch of military conquests that fail to the in the Mediterranean. He spends a whole lot of money on luxuries and fancy facilities and parties, and he's a womanizer. And one of the examples we saw was that in one of his palaces, there were several palaces in the Persian Empire. One of them was in Susa. And in Susa, the palace, it was a winter palace actually, there was authority structure there. There was a queen at that palace over that region. And a queen would be someone who is one of the king's many wives. The king had a lot of wives. And if one stood out to him in a special way, he'd make her queen. That would give her political clout and power and things. And she would be the queen. So in Susa, in that palace, in that region, Queen Vashti was his wife who was in that role. But she and him had a clash. They had a clash when she refused to accommodate an obscene request from him. And that upset him. And so to make a spectacle of her, he removed her as queen, removed her from his harem, and had her tossed to the curb to show that she doesn't have the clout she thought she had. A couple years, some time goes by, he's back at the palace in Susa. He's advised to round up some more young virgins to add to his harem of wives. And then maybe he finds one that's suitable. He can make her to be the next queen instead of Vashti. And so they round up some young virgin girls, which is a messed up situation. One of the girls they round up is a young woman named Esther, who is a Jewish girl, although they do not tell us in this. She does not tell anyone that she's Jewish. She's advised by people to kind of keep her life a little mysterious. And she's brought into the harem with the other young women to be brought into Xerxes' chambers, to be made his wife, and then to be added to the harem of other wives. And, of course, Esther stands out from the get-go, and sure enough, by the time that a couple years pass by the time Xerxes gets to her, he's just impressed with her. She stands out so well, and he's infatuated. He makes Esther his queen in place of Vashti, and now she has political clout and position in Susa and the local regions. Now, at that part of the story, she appoints her father figure, a man named Mordecai, to a position in the palace. Mordecai was actually her older cousin who, Esther had went through a lot of hard times. Her mom and dad passed away when she was young. So her older cousin, or kind of her uncle Mordecai, brought her into his family and raised her as his own daughter. And so when she was brought into the harem, he's concerned for her. He's keeping tabs. When she becomes queen, she gives him a job in the palace because she has the power to do that now. But she doesn't tell anyone they're connected. She has a couple trusted confidants who relay messages back and forth between him and her, but no one else knows that they know each other. But that's his way of being close enough to have influence in her life. She looked up to him a lot, and so he's working in that regard. Now, during his time working in the palace, Mordecai uncovers a plot to assassinate the king Xerxes. Two men were plotting his death. So Mordecai tells Esther about the assassination plot. Esther tells Xerxes, and she gives it to him in Mordecai's name. Xerxes investigates it. Sure enough, he has these would-be assassins put to death by impaling them on a sharpened pole, which is a pretty brutal way to die, but it was a way to make a statement. You don't just die when you try to assassinate the king. You die a terrible death, so don't try that again. Anybody else? Anyhow, so they're killed, and this is all written down in the king's record books of events that happened at that time. Well, we met one other character last week His name was Haman. Haman was a man who was rising through the ranks. He was a mover and a shaker. He was an ambitious man who was capable. He was rising through the ranks of the kingdom, and he found himself in the king's orbit. And once there, the king noticed him and liked him, thought he was sharp, thought he was capable, and they became friends. They probably, they watched sports together. Maybe they would watch the local, the chariot races at the Susa 500 every year. I don't know. They would enjoy some. They would drink together. They would hang out. They were friends. And King Xerxes made Haman his second most powerful man in Susa and that region of the kingdom. And so Haman is a man of influence now. Only the king is higher than him. Even the queen and other important people are lower in the totem pole than Haman. And the problem with the story is that Haman is not a good man. He's a powerful man. He's an ambitious man. He is not a good man. He's a narcissist. You saw last week already. One of the things, for example, that the king ordered was that when Haman walked through the courtyard or near the royal property, going back and forth to home or work, anyone who saw Haman passing by had to get down on the ground and bow down to show him obeisance. And Haman expected this. He expected it to happen that way. Because as we're going to see again today, he's so messed up. He is so messed up that it's not enough to be exalted and given a position. It's one of those things where I also want other people to be put low. Because them being put low makes me feel taller, makes me feel more honored. And so everyone had to bow down when he went by. The problem was Mordecai wouldn't do it, whether it was for religious reasons or he just didn't like the jerk, Mordecai wouldn't do it. And so people who wanted to impress Haman because he's powerful tattletale on Mordecai, and Haman began to notice that Mordecai won't bow down, and that was so offensive to him. So he makes the logical decision, the only logical decision, I must kill him. Right? I mean, that sounds reasonable. I must kill the guy. He wouldn't bow down to me. So he plots his death. He actually finds out it's not enough to kill him. He wants to kill everyone he loves. This guy really deserves to die, and everyone he loves. So he finds out that he's a Jew. The Jews are sort of a scattered people in the empire. Many of them have returned back to Samaria and Israel, the area that we call the Levant. They've returned to that area over time, but many were still scattered throughout what is the Persian Empire. And so Haman figures out that Mordecai is a Jew. He wants to exterminate all the Jews just to get back at Mordecai. So he gets with his friends. They basically roll the dice, and they decide on a future date of March the 7th as the date they want to put this mass execution plot into place, this terrible plot. He goes to King Xerxes and he tells him, look, there's a group of troublemakers in your kingdom, a group of people that have been scattered. Historically, they're trouble. I'm sensing trouble. You need to let me take care of it. He does not tell them who they are. He just says, trust me, I'm your guy. I'll take care of the problem for you. I just need your authority. And King Xerxes trusts Haman, gives him the power to pass laws to fix this problem out of just blind faith in him. Haman passes decrees and sends them all over the kingdom saying, on March the 7th of next year, everyone's to take the Jews around you and put them to death, kill them. And to incentivize people to do that, because, people are going to feel bad or feel sympathetic or maybe try to protect people. To make people cooperate, he said, if you kill the Jews, you get their property. You get their money, you get their clothes, you get their house, whatever, it's yours. So this was to incentivize the greed and the desire to get ahead in others. And the plot is laid. Everyone's shocked. The kingdom's shocked. Some are excited. Some are terrified. And Mordecai is terrified. And this future date for the execution served two purposes. Purpose one, it gave the kingdom time to hear the message. Everyone gets ready, put the plan into place so it's well ready to go. The other purpose was it would drive them crazy, because when you know you're going to die on a certain date, your execution is looming. You know what I'm saying? So, as the date gets closer, Mordecai is especially tormented. In fact, as soon as he hears the news, he's so upset that others like him are just mourning and wailing and tearing their clothes. Esther hears about it. Mordecai sends word to Esther saying, you've got to go to the king, tell the king what's happening, and beg him for the lives of your people. But no one knows her people because she's kept a secret. She's a very mysterious person in that way. Because you got to go to the king and beg for our lives. And Esther tells him, look, I can't. The king, you can't just walk into the king's inner courts without being invited. If you walk into the king's inner courts without invitation, it's instant death. They execute you as a threat. And she's the queen, but she's like, look, I'm one of many wives. And he's not called for me in over 30 days. It's been over a month. So the assumption is he's with one of his other wives or mistresses or somebody else. He's not into me right now. I can't just walk in there and assume too much. Look what happened to my predecessor, Vashti, when she did that. I can't. And Mordecai says to Esther, you have to. You've got to try. And he told her, who knows? Maybe, just maybe, God brought you here to this spot for such a time as this. In other words, everything that's happened in your life, bad, good, everything, the death of your parents as a young girl, being brought to rape, be raised in Mordecai's house, as one of his own children in Susa, being found amongst the other girls, being put in the harem, being chosen as queen. Who knows if everything that has happened in your life is a macro journey to get you to this very moment, and you have been brought here for such a time as this. Interesting. And Esther says, you're right. Fast for 3 days and three nights. Don't eat anything or drink anything. I'll do the same with my maids. And then I'll go into the king and take a risk. And if I must die, I must die. That's where we left off. That's catching you up in case you missed the story. Well, Esther 5, verse 1, we pick up the story right there. And verse 1, on the third day of the fast, Esther put on her royal robes, and she entered the inner court of the palace just across from the king's hall. The king was sitting on his royal throne facing the entrance. So she's already coming to a spot where she can be put to death for what she's about to do. She's scared. The moment of truth has arrived. But she's still out there, and the king sees her before she puts herself further in harm's way. It says, when he saw Queen Esther standing there in the inner court, he welcomed her and held out the gold scepter to her. So Esther approached, and she touched the end of the scepter. So instantly, if we read between the lines a little bit, we can discover that Xerxes has not seen her in over a month, not because he's had another girl on the side. It's because he's been busy with his job. Maybe they've been invading the Mediterranean again, failing again, who knows? Maybe he's been a business. And so it's been a while. And all of a sudden, Queen Esther, his favorite, walks in, and it just like lights a fire in him. He's like, oh. So he holds out the scepter and instantly, come on in. And she comes forward and she touches the end of the scepter. Then the king asked her, what do you want, Queen Esther? What is your request? I will give it to you, even if it is half the kingdom. Girl, you looking so fine. I mean, listen, what do you want? You name it, name that price, you know. And this phrase, up to half the kingdom, this might be kind of a cliche. It may be one of those things throughout cultural history where we see people will say something like that. And the idea is to say, an exaggerative offer, and you're supposed to be smart enough to say, of course, I would not accept that, you know. But anyhow, the idea is basically he's saying, you got a pretty large runway of whatever you want, because I have missed you, and I'm glad to see you, girl. So, you know, what do you want? Tell me, and it's all yours. And so, verse 4, Esther replied, well, if it please the king, let the king and Haman come today for a banquet I have prepared for the king. While she was not eating, her maids were apparently, and her team was preparing a feast. And she says, come to a banquet today. Now, that's interesting. Maybe she doesn't want to ask him for the lives of her people in the middle of the court, in her cold inner courtroom, so official. Maybe she wants to get him away and wine him and dine him a little bit. Maybe she wants to break the ice and set the atmosphere and ask him less formally. I don't know. That makes sense, right? But she says, bring Haman with you. The Haman's the guy that's trying to kill them all. Why would she invite him too? Anyhow, the king turned to his attendants and said, tell Haman to come quickly to a banquet as Esther has requested. So the king and Haman went to Esther's banquet. What a weird saying. By the way, it was very common in this particular setting and in other settings like this that these would be big tables with lavish amounts of food, and they wouldn't just have chairs. They'd roll up basically like couches for you to sit on. It's your own couch, or almost like a bed. It's not like a couch like we would exactly picture today. But you could sit up at the table. You could recline back in luxury. And it's very intimate, really. Which makes sense. The king and queen are there, but Haman's there too. And they're eating around the table. And while they were drinking wine, the king said to Esther, "Now tell me what you really want." Like, I know you didn't just come in to invite me to dinner. We could have had Uber Eats already by this point, you know. What do you really want? What is your request? I will give it to you, even if it's half the kingdom. I can only imagine that Haman perked up at that. Like, ooh. Oh, wow, that's a pretty generous offer. I don't know what she's going to say, but I know what I would say. Half the kingdom, please. You know, money. You know, I need something right here. Because this is a good offer. Esther replied, "This is my request and deepest wish. If I have found favor with the king, and if it pleases the king to grant my request and do what I ask, please come with Haman tomorrow to the banquet I will prepare for you. Then I will explain what this is all about." That's really weird. Is this nerves? Is she just nervous, wants another day to ask the question? Is this providence? What's going on? But she's like, if you really want to know, if you really want to give me what I want, then I'm going to tease and I'll make you wait one more day to find out what it is. Come back tomorrow, and I'll tell you. Okay. Well, it says in verse 9 that Haman was a happy man as he left the banquet. Can we just pause here and acknowledge that Haman had a lot of reason to be happy? Right? I mean, Haman had a lot of reason. Think about his life. He's trying to be ambitious and rise through the ranks. He's risen through the ranks. He gets in the king's orbit. He gets noticed by the king. He is empowered to second in command of Susa and that region by the king. He is given authority to execute his enemies and have pretty much free reign with trust from the king. People bow down when he walks past, which makes them feel even bigger. And now he's invited to the queen's house with just like the people who are serving the food and her and the king, which makes sense, and then him reclining on couches. He's like, this is good. He goes home happy. But when he saw Mordecai sitting at the palace gate, not standing up or trembling nervously before him, Haman became furious. It's interesting. You know, he's had this execution date pending on March the 7th of the upcoming year to have Mordecai and all the other his people killed. But now, and the advantage of that was, again, logistics and then dread. It's kind of a torture to wait for your upcoming execution date. But he would have thought by now that Mordecai might be trembling in front of him, maybe come begging for his life, ask for an audience and plead for mercy, or at least start showing him respect. But Mordecai won't bow down. He won't even stand up. He won't even shake and tremble. He's like, and ignores him. And it just like irks him. He's like, It's like, you know, putting off his death was a good move until the guy won't, every passing day he's still alive, I got to walk past and remember this guy doesn't even respect me enough to show me my honor. It just eats at him so much. However, he restrained himself and went on home. Then Haman gathered together his friends and Zeresh his wife. So he gets everyone together, and he boasted to them about his great wealth and his many children, probably many wives. He bragged about the honors the king had given him and how he had been promoted over all the other nobles and officials, blah, blah, blah. Can you only imagine that his wife and friends have heard this talk more than once? You know, but what do you say to this guy? He's powerful. You don't want to make him mad, obviously. You want him to butter your bread. He does that. You know, he's well off. So they're all like, oh, yes, Haman, tell us again about how awesome you are. Who has it better than you? Nobody, you know. And so they're just, you know, listening in as he brags. Verse 12, then Haman added, and that's not all. Queen Esther invited only me and the king himself to a banquet she prepared for us, and she has invited me to dine with her and the king again tomorrow. Life is good if your name is Haman. But then he added, but this is all worth nothing as long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting there at the palace gate. What? This, all that he's been bragging about, all the stuff he's been bragging about, how good, how no one had a life like him. Who has it as good as me? Nobody. I mean, nobody, literally. He says, all this is worth nothing as long as that one thing I don't like is not fixed. All this is worth nothing as long as that one person out there still bothers me and I can't do anything about it. All of this is worth nothing to me as long as this one situation, I can't manipulate the outcome. As long as I see Mordecai sitting there, I don't care. All these things mean nothing. They're worth nothing to me. Wow. I'd throw stones, but I think we can relate if we were honest. When this is done, I'm sorry, his wife, so Haman's wife is Zeresh, and all his friends suggested, you know, set up a sharpened pole that stands 75 feet tall. Overkill. Okay. And in the morning, ask the king to impale Mordecai on it. He's going to ask this. It's crazy. Like, impaling someone on a sharpened pole as a form of execution is very painful and very humiliating, usually public. That's not something you do to every person you get rid of. That's something that in our last story, the king did to the eunuchs. Remember the eunuchs who tried to assassinate him? I understand you want to kill someone who tries to assassinate you in a very brutal and painful and humiliating way to make a point. But Haman wants to do it to Mordecai for the simple, terrible crime of what? Not bowing down to him. That's a crime worthy of the worst kind of death, right? We'll impale him on a sharpened pole, nice and tall. We'll get it built. And then you can ask the king, by the time the day's over, he could be dead. And then they said this, and when this is done, you can go on your merry way to the banquet with the king. Once this is done, all your problems will be gone, and then you can finally be happy, right? Then you can finally enjoy life once this thing is fixed. Well, this pleased Haman, and he ordered the pole to be set up. And I just wish that someone in Haman's life had the freedom to ask him a hard question. I don't think anyone dared. But I wish someone could have said, hey, Haman, can I just ask you something? Is this one thing worth everything? Is this one thing worth everything? And he would probably say, well, no, of course not. I mean, all these blessings are so awesome. But really, yes, it is worth everything. When you're at such a spot in your life, Haman, where you can say, all these good things I've just mentioned mean nothing as long as that thing. It's so big to me. It's so important to me. Everything else pales in comparison to what I can't get, what I want. Is this one thing worth everything? Well, anyhow, he goes to bed that night, ready to get up bright and early and ask the king to let him kill Mordecai the next day. Goes to bed. Everyone's asleep. Not everyone's asleep. Chapter 6, verse 1 says, that night the king had trouble sleeping. So he ordered an attendant to bring the book of the history of his reign so it could be read to him. Now, as a guy who loves history, I'm only slightly offended that the king decides the best way to cure his insomnia is to bring a history book to be read to him. I'll try to get over that offense. But I don't think it's because history was boring. I think the reason was because he's like, look, I'm uneasy about what's going on, and I can't sleep. Maybe he woke up, and maybe it's the middle of the night when he's awake again, and he's like, I can't get back to sleep. The night's half over. Maybe if someone just came in and read some of the things that have happened in the kingdom, it might help me see, am I missing something, or is everything okay? I just need some reassurance. So he's having his story read to him until morning. And as the morning begins to dawn, they get to the part of the story where they read the part where those two guys tried to kill the king, but Mordecai had sent word to the king to warn him of his plot, and because of Mordecai, his life was saved. And the king remembers that story, and he says to his audience, to the people who are reading to him, he says, what reward or recognition do we ever give Mordecai for doing this? The king asked. His attendants replied, nothing has been done for him. Whoops, that's an oversight. He saved my life. We should have done something, at least a Starbucks gift card or something. I mean, we missed the boat on this one. Well, while he's pondering this, the morning has rolled in, and bright and early, Haman has arrived to ask the king permission to kill Mordecai on the sharpened pole he's having built in his house. So he walks in, and the king's thinking it through. And in verse number 5, the attendants replied to the king, "Haman is out in the court. Bring him in," the king ordered. The king's like, "Hey, Haman's here. If anyone can help me think of something to do, Haman can help me because he is smart and he's my buddy." So Haman came in, and the king said, "What should I do to honor a man who truly pleases me?" You got good ideas, pal. Tell me, what should I do to honor a man who truly pleases me? Haman thought to himself, "Whom would the king wish to honor more than me?" He's like, "I know what's going on here. I mean, I'm the second most powerful man in the kingdom. I have free reign. I mean, I get past laws. I went to the party last night at the queen's house with the king. Just the three of us. We're tight, man. And I'm going again tonight for another one." I mean, so he's roundabout asking me what I want for my birthday. I love this. So he begins to think of a good idea. What can I ask for? So he replied, "If the king wishes to honor someone," wink, wink, "he should bring out," I know, "he should bring out one of the king's own royal robes." Because, you know, only the king, only royalty wears that. So that person could be like royalty for a moment. "And as well as a horse that the king himself has ridden." Yeah, that's it. "And one with a royal emblem on its head," because, again, that means you're royalty. That would be a good honor for me. I mean, for somebody who you want to honor. Then he says this, "Let the robes and horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble officials. Let him see that the man whom the king wishes to honor is dressed in the king's robes and led through the city square on the king's horse." Do you see that there? Do you catch it? Notice what's happening right there. Again, it's never enough for Haman to feel honored, to feel promoted, to enjoy the blessings of his life. It always had to mean someone else had to be put down. For someone else to be degraded makes him feel more upgraded. So his idea is, find one of the king's most noble officials. In other words, someone of clout, someone of importance in this kingdom. Someone that everybody is like, ooh, you know, that person's somebody like a rival or a peer of mine. Have that most noble official be forced to dress this man the king wishes to honor, put this robe on him like a servant would do, and help him on the horse. And lead him around the city like a servant so everyone can see this important person doing this lowly job to honor, to show the difference. Because for Haman, it was always about lifting me up means putting someone else down. You, me. You see the difference right there? You know, that's what I'm looking for. So this is what I want. Have some noble official lead him around. And that's not all he said. Have this official shout as they go, "This is what the king does for somebody he wishes to honor." Make him be a herald and sing the guy's praises. That would really make the guy feel extra important. That's what you should do, king. Thanks for asking. "Excellent," the king said to Haman. "Quick," good idea, by the way, good idea, pal. "Quick, take the robes and my horse and do just as you have said. For Mordecai the Jew, who sits at the gate of the palace, leave out nothing you have suggested." I can just imagine the color draining from Haman's face in this moment. He's like, "Oh, wait, that wasn't for me? Wait, that was for someone else who's going to get the kind of honor I recommended? Ugh. Wait, it's Mordecai the Jew? Oh, wait, I'm supposed to be the most noble official leading him around and honoring him? What's he going to do now? He can't push back." The king's like, "Well, this is your idea. What did you, were you thinking this was about you?" He couldn't push back. The king says what it is, it's what it is. He's stuck. Good idea, Haman. I love it. Carry it out, pal. Hey, drinks later, right? Have fun. He's stuck. Now, let's be real. For those of us who are healthy, that wouldn't be such a bad job to do, right? Even if you're important in your company or your world, if you have the chance to honor someone who deserves some honor, and you can do something to serve them and honor them in a moment to celebrate them, most of us would be like, "Cool, I'm glad to help honor someone who has it coming." But that's not how Haman was wired. He wanted honor, but he was a narcissistic monster. And this was not something he could just do. It was something that was utterly devastating. But he's stuck. And so, verse 11. So Haman took the robes and put them on Mordecai, your left arm, please, sir, and placed him on the king's own horse. Here's a little boost, sir, right? And led him through the city square, shouting, this is what the king does for someone he wishes to honor. This is what the king does for someone he wishes to honor. This is what the king does for someone he wishes to honor. You know, he's just going around parading him everywhere. Everyone knows. Look, everyone knows. Isn't that Haman, the guy that we're supposed to bow down to, like leading this man around and honoring him? And that man he's honoring, isn't that Mordecai, the guy he wants to kill because everyone bows down to him? I mean, everyone knows the T. Okay? And so when it's over, it says afterward, Mordecai returned to the palace gate. Thanks, pal. But Haman hurried home, dejected and completely humiliated. When Haman told his wife Zeresh and all his friends what had happened, his wise advisors and his wife said, since Mordecai, this man who has humiliated you, is of Jewish birth, you will never succeed in your plans against him. It will be fatal to continue opposing him. Can I spell that out for you a little bit better? They're saying to him, if this guy that you are trying to kill today has the tables turned on you, is part of the group of people that you're trying to exterminate nation, you know, kingdom-wide, this was a little sign, this was an omen today that it ain't going to work out for you very well. This is a little warning shot that this is out of your hands now. So you better back off, pal. Well, while they were still talking, the king's eunuchs arrived, and they quickly took Haman to the banquet Esther had prepared. Come on, buddy, time to go to the banquet. We're running late. And Haman's a little frazzled still, you know, runs some fingers through his hair and just gets out the door to go to the banquet, all shook. So the king and Haman went to Queen Esther's banquet. On this, and by the way, he mentioned he's only distracted. On the second occasion, while they were drinking wine, the king, again, they get a little inebriated, you know, loosen everyone up a little bit. While they're drinking wine, the king said to Esther, girl, tell me what you want, Queen Esther. Here, we're back again. What is your request? I will give it to you, even if it is half the kingdom, my lady. And as he's saying this, I imagine that Haman's been distracted by his terrible day. But maybe that kind of snaps him out of it. He's like, oh, that's right. She's supposed to ask for something up to half the kingdom. Esther, I know what I'd be asking for. What's she going to say? Everyone's riveted to the moment. Queen Esther replied, if I have found favor with the king, and if it pleases the king to grant my request, I ask that my life and the lives of my people will be spared. Huh? That was not expected. For my people and I have been sold to those who would kill, slaughter, and annihilate us. I wonder if at this point Haman has any kind of dots connecting in his head, or if he's just still so frazzled from the day and a little drunk and he doesn't know. She says, if we had merely been sold as slaves, I could remain quiet, for that would be too trivial a matter to warrant disturbing the king. That's brilliant on Esther's part. She says to the king, look, if someone was just trying to take me and my people and make us into slaves, you are too important of a man to be bothered with our problem. That's just our bad luck. I wouldn't mess with this. But it's our lives. Please. Verse 5, who would do such a thing, King Xerxes demanded. Who would be so presumptuous as to touch you? He's not used to, you know, nobody, none of us like it when somebody that we care about, we're unable to protect them, right? Isn't it a terrible feeling, men, when you feel like a protector by nature and you can't do something to protect your wife in a situation because you're not strong enough? It is so devastating. Mom, dad, you have kids, you feel like you're supposed to take care of them. If something happens to them, it not only hurts you, it makes you feel like you failed, right? I mean, it matters to us. King Xerxes is not used to feeling out of control. Someone's threatening his queen and the people, and he doesn't even know about it. It's embarrassing, it's angering. Who would do such a thing? Who would be so presumptuous as to touch you? Esther replied, this wicked Haman is our adversary and our enemy. And Haman grew pale with fright before the king and queen. The color drained from his face for the second time that day. Then the king jumped to his feet in a rage and went out into the palace garden. At least he went outside to cool off. Haman, however, stayed behind to plead for his life with Queen Esther, for he knew the king intended to kill him. Haman had a lot of come-to-Jesus moment here. He's like, oh, wait, I was going to kill the Mordecai and his people, the Jews. She's a Jewish person. Oh. So he's like, king's out in the garden fuming. He runs over to her to beg her. She's like, he's going to kill me. You've got to please spare my life. In despair, he fell on the couch where Queen Esther was reclining just as the king was returning from the palace garden. He falls on the couch and she's laying on saying, oh, please help. It's been a rough day. And the king walks in and sees that. The king exclaimed, will he even assault the queen right here in the palace before my very eyes? Oh boy, that's not what I was doing. As soon as the king spoke, his attendants covered Haman's face, signaling his doom. Covered his face with those bags and basically say, you're on your way to be executed. Whew. Then Harbona, one of the king's eunuchs, said, Haman has a sharpened pole that stands 75 feet tall in his own courtyard. He intended to use it to impale Mordecai, the man who saved the king from assassination. Then impale Haman on it, the king ordered, you know. Just, they did. So they impaled Haman on the pole he set up for Mordecai, and the king's anger subsided. Can't imagine the last few moments of Haman's life? Seriously. Can you just think about, like, the time the bag was put over his head? Did it take an hour or less than that? How long before he's executed? What's he thinking? Like, I had the perfect life. What happened? What went wrong? I wonder, as they're impaling him on that pole and raising it, he's thinking, how did it come to this? I wonder if they kept the bag on his head as a statement, or if they took it off so everyone could see him and he could see everybody else. As he's bleeding out, he can look over the crowd and of people who always bowed down to him when he walked by, now gathering in shock to watch him die a horrific and humiliating death. I wonder if in the crowd he looks over and sees Mordecai standing there, watching him. I wonder if the last couple of thoughts ran through his head beside the pole was, how did it come to this? We'll come back to that in just a moment here. There's more story. We're not going to read it. Let me tell you about it. The next day, Esther comes back to the inner court. She's a crying mess. She walks in, which is, again, not invited, but the king is feeling very protective of her right now. He holds up the scepter. She comes in. She says, please, you got to reverse the order to kill all my people across the land on March the 7th. And at this time, the king figures out who Mordecai is. He's a father figure. He raised this girl, his queen, when her parents died. He has been, you know, he saved the king from assassination. He matters to Esther. And so he's like, you know what? You're the man. He puts him in Haman's old position. And now Mordecai is the second most powerful person in Susa and that part of the empire, even more than Esther. He is Mordecai, that job that belonged to Haman. And the king says, Mordecai, what do we do? And together, the two of them work out a plan to send a new law out saying that on the day that was set to be an execution date for your people, everyone's ordered to help them fight against their enemies instead and turn the tables on their enemies and protect them. And everyone who got the message listened, because as Mordecai rose, you know, fear of him spread through the kingdom, and the king himself was involved. So that seems important. And everyone's like, okay. And on March the 7th, instead of being slaughtered, the Hebrew people were able to be saved. And that's such a big deal. That to this day, this is a holiday celebrated in Jewish culture. Not every Jewish person celebrates every ancient Jewish custom and holiday, just like some of us don't even celebrate our own national holidays, Labor Day, whatever we do. But in Jewish culture, many Jewish people to this day still celebrate what they call the Festival of Purim because of this story 2,500 years later. It still matters today. And that's the story. That's the story of Esther. That's the story. That's the last story of our Old Testament journey. And we've completed it. Now, we're going to go on. Say, what's next? You'll find out. We kind of know what's next, but we're going to roll into the holiday season in an intentional way starting next week. We'll talk about that next week. But for today, I just want to come back to the story. Because we learned a lesson last week from Esther about faith and what faith looks like. But today I want us to learn a lesson from Haman. Can we learn a lesson from him? Let me ask you a question. Is there one thing that makes everything else feel like nothing in your life? Is there one thing in your life that makes everything else feel like nothing? Like everything, every good thing in your life, you know, we live in the most prosperous nation in the world in a great time of history. Fill in the blank with any blessings you have. Is there something in your life that despite all the good things of your life, they're there, but you're not really focused on them or thinking about them because there's this one thing that's bothering you that's not right. There's this one situation that is just so maddening that you're losing sleep over it. You talk about it all the time. It consumes you. Is there one thing that despite all the good things in your life, they all kind of fade in the background because that one person that's annoying you, that one circumstance that's not right, and you're just like, oh. And I want us to ask ourselves the question that Haman should have asked himself. Is this one thing worth everything? And of course we would say, no, of course it's not. I know I wouldn't trade all my blessings away to fix this one thing. But in a way, we're in the same boat saying, all this good stuff means nothing to me right now because I'm so consumed by this situation with my health, with my finances, with my job, with my enemy, with some drama, with some frustrations, with a circumstance I can't figure out. And it's just so big that it overgulfs everything else. Is this one thing worth everything? Well, you say, well, I don't mean everything. I wouldn't trade it. Haman did not mean to either, but he did. Yeah, I know what you're saying, Arlen. I kind of get it, but here's the thing. Good point. I'll apply it to my life, but if this one thing would get better, I'd be content. I don't need everything. I don't need to be rich. I hear this all the time. I don't need to be rich. I just need to be a little bit better off. I don't need to be everything. I just need this one problem to go away. That's all. Then I'd be content. Let me just give you a little thought that we need to remember, all of us. I do. All of us need to remember this. Contentment comes from within, not without. You can change your external circumstances all you want to. It won't bring you contentment because they're not the reason you don't have it. It's an internal issue. And people have constantly through life shifted. People have constantly through life made changes thinking that will fix it. And all it does is move the goalpost. And something else doesn't do the trick after that. So I want to give you a statement and talk about it and we'll be done. A statement to take home with you today. It goes, write it down, take a picture, whatever you need to do. It goes like this. Don't lose what you have longing for what you don't. That's it. Don't lose what you have longing for what you don't. Haman lost his life longing for what he couldn't have. And people through history have lost their lives longing for what they couldn't have. But sometimes it's not a life. Sometimes it's something else. Lost a job. Lost a relationship that was very important. Lost an opportunity. Lost a friendship. Lost some influence. Lost some peace. Lost a lot of things. And it's always bad when you get to the spot where you look back and say, man, I had so much and I kind of lost it all and I took it for granted, but how did that happen? Because I was so hyper-fixated. You were so hyper-fixated on this thing that wasn't right. And I know where we are. We're like, amen, you're right, Arlen. I will do that next time after this one thing I'm working on now. If I get this one thing, if God could just answer that prayer, if I could just make that thing work out, then from that point on, I will apply that. I agree. No, you won't. I've been doing this a long time. I'm a human. I've got my own propensity this way, and so do you. I've been pastoring a long time. Let me tell you what I've seen. I can tell you the stories all day long. I'm picturing a man right now many, many years ago that no one knows who sat with me. I can remember the place we sat eating out. His life had unraveled so much because of all the things he had done, being discontent. And he was sat there and said, I just want this one thing back, just one thing. He said, I get this one thing, none of the other stuff matters. Nothing will matter, just that one thing. And I looked at him and I felt so bad, but I said, I don't think that's true. I think if you got that one thing back, that will last a while, but no, that's all I need, that's all I need. And miracle of all miracles, it worked out for him. And for a while, he was happy. And then the goalpost shifted. That itch that we always try to scratch, that always moves around, that you can never find. Here's the problem. And I can tell you that story in 30 different versions. Because contentment comes from within. And it's impossible for us to look for it without and find it, because the goalpost will move. There's a new frustration. There's a new imperfect thing. Think about Haman. For Haman, it was the guy wouldn't bow down to him. For Haman, later, it was the guy is going to die for not bowing down to me, but even that's not good enough. He needs to be scared in the meantime. You know, there's always a moving of the goalpost when you're looking for our happiness and our joy and our contentment to come from without. So here's my advice to you. Don't lose what you have longing for what you don't. Is this one thing worth everything? Like Haman, we're blessed. And I'll close with this. We have so much. We have so much, folks. We just forget sometimes. There's a pile of things. We can every day of our life say, look at all that God has done. He's been so, so good. Life has been good for us. Yes, there are some things that are not perfect, but guess what? There'll always be things that aren't perfect. There's some people that are frustrating. There'll always be people that are frustrating. There's things that are not exactly like I would manipulate them to be. That's life. But there's so much good that I'm going to be content and joyful with all that I have. I hope the Old Testament has been useful to you. And I hope that you'll join us as we start what comes next.